I've had enough of fighting and retreating. Wiener. There'll be no room for me after the war, remember? The veteran had opened fire. He was firing like a madman at the Russians who were coming along the trench. Fahim called again, but the sound of the gun drowned out his voice. We ran back off that ground which was shifting and crumbling under our feet. The position was no longer tenable. Why didn't Wiener follow us? 10 minutes later, we plunged down into our mortar and anti-tank positions. 500 yards to the east, we could see a thick cloud of smoke rising from the position we had just left. As the deluge of war poured over us, and the parapet of the gun pit trembled like the railings of a ship caught in a storm, we clung to our guns with trembling hands, as to our last salvation. The fire from the ships made a critical difference to us. Without it we would have been overrun. The danger was so pressing that no one could leave his post. Through the sharp noise of the guns, we could hear the wounded groaning. Such a peak of tragedy was beyond understanding. Each of us felt alone, stripped of all feeling and all judgment. Perhaps there would not even be time for a few hours of rest before our deaths. The men waiting at the piers had gone back to points of defense. This was not altruism, but simple self-interest. They knew that if Memel fell, no one would leave. At a high pitch of fury, they drew on their last reserves of strength to keep watch, and prevent Ivan from destroying their cavalry and their hope. Memel still held Memel, a small island of courage drawn from an infinity of anguish. But the boats didn't come. Had we been abandoned? Had this final reason for fighting vanished too? Was this the end? However, the following night, a ship drew into shore like a ghost. A crowd of dying men ran toward her, fighting among each other for places. No order could have held them back. In any case, the officers were in the same state as their men. Here, no one fought because a whistle blew. We fought because there was no other possibility. It seemed that the ship had not come to pick up men, but food. We had enough food to hold out for another 3 months, but since we were to be withdrawn immediately, these supplies should have been destroyed. However, to the south, there were hundreds of thousands of refugees who were dying of hunger and cold. The crowd which had collected near the shore heard the voice of the naval officer shouting through an amplifier. At first they couldn't understand these words, which seemed to be coming from another world, from a man whose floating mobility allowed him to see the worst from a distance. They vaguely grasped that from their misery they could still help other people farther to the south. A single word ran through their minds in an endless refrain: immediately, immediately, immediately. The boat loaded up with our supplies and took on a few wounded. Immediately. The crowd stood motionless, wrapped in a silence as large as the night. Our diminished group had been sent to the northern edge of the stronghold, to a beach beside the sea, overhung by moderately high cliffs. We still held the cliff tops, in bunkers which had been built facing the sea. However, the Russians had also reached the cliff tops at several points. And even though they were not yet there in strength, they had sent out sharpshooters, who controlled the rocky beach along which we were crawling under their fire. The German positions on these heights were fortified islands, surrounded by the enemy, and living on God knows what. There was no longer any question of the Grossdeutschland division, or any other division. Everything which could still move in Memel was alive, and anything alive had to be used. A ragged officer had brought us to this point, where he feared the Russians might break through our rear lines. Although the position was very dangerous, it was at least somewhat less dangerous than the official front. Tanks couldn't get through unless they reached the heights, which we still dominated and weakly defended. For shelter, we used the holes dug by civilian refugees who had waited here for deliverance by sea. We were in almost constant contact with the Russians. Ivan moved along the length of the coast, peppering us from the cliffs. Sometimes he used mortars. The sandy soil was as churned up as if a harrow had been through it, and we were constantly digging out both the living and the dead. However, in this soft soil, the impact of missiles was usually dissipated. The Russians were just playing with us, but they gave us no respite. If our heads hadn't been empty, they would have burst with exasperation. Although the cold was cruel, nature had also sent us fog, which was an ally. The Russians had infiltrated our lines, and were sometimes even killed from behind. They were afraid too and were hoping that support from their artillery and tanks would crush once and for all this cemetery where even the dead seemed to defy them. They infiltrated with great caution, and when they thought we could hear them, they shouted insults at us, telling us what they would do to our wives and mothers. They also said they were planning to remove parts of ourselves. Sometimes, too, they sang. Howls and I listened, with our fingers on our triggers, because they often sang and shouted like that to distract us. Ai mei drugia germansky, kak sabachi kolat. Ya tibai skarja spasibo uyaudna mamanshka. Then they would count. Listen, German soldiers. You are going to die. Listen, raz, dva, dry. Then they would let off a volley, while we listened in silence, like antennae destined to pick up all the ignominies on earth. During the night, two more boats came. At the risk of instant death, a crowd of ragged soldiers ran to board them. We were too far from the shore to get there in time. As the nausea rose in our throats, we stood powerless, trying to calculate our isolation. Every time a boatload withdrew, our defense was weakened to that degree. Nothing could stop Ivan now. As soon as the wave broke, we would run like rats. The long nightmare turned heavily in our minds, and we all trembled uncontrollably. Howls had lifted his gun to his head. I must have stared at him with enough sorrow to stop him. He turned back onto his stomach, and crushed his face into the ground. The next day, we were still covered with fog. The front was quiet. Were the Russians preparing something? Howls and Schlisser had crawled toward the water, toward the smashed car which stood in the spray at the edge of the beach. I joined them, taking maximum precautions. Howls spoke in a half whisper. You help us, Sager. We'll get those inner tubes. Three of them are still good. To make floats? Yes, a raft. But be careful. We don't have any tools, so we'll have to use bayonets. Do it like this but be careful. I felt as if a shaft of light had pierced my mind. A raft, for a long time, but this also might be our last chance. We had no tools, and we would have to get the tires off the wheels without lifting them. Trembling with anxiety, we set about this desperate task. The inner tubes had to be full of air, otherwise they'd be no good to us. Fahim came over and joined us. You're crazy, he said. Even if you get the tubes out, they're sure to burst. After all, it's the tire that holds the pressure in. It was true that we'd been half off our heads for quite a while now. We couldn't give up the idea of escape, and received Fahim's objectivity with ferocious scowls. Then let's take the whole wheel, Howells said. I'm sure they won't float, said Fahim. Shut up, roared Howells. You stick to your god. Myself, I have more confidence in these tires. Fahim said nothing more, and like the rest of us tried to free the nuts with the tip of his bayonet. It took us at least 2 hours to complete the job. We also had to dig away the sand from under the right front tire, as the wreck was lying on its side. We could hear the sound of heavy mortars in Memel. The ground shook as far out as we were, and it seemed likely that the Russians had taken a big slice of what was left of the town. We no longer dared to think about what might be happening there, concentrating instead on the ridiculous work we had undertaken. Twice we were forced to give it up, and get back to our holes. The Russians were infiltrating all along our positions, crawling through the fog almost everywhere. Howells and I clung to each other in our refuge. For the 7th or 8th time, we had fired almost point-blank on Asiatic-looking men, with Asiatic faces. Each time, our Volkssturm shook in our hands, and we trembled with fright. By evening, the whole city looked like a volcano. Stalin's organs were howling without stopping, loosing a storm of random fire. Our shattered nerves no longer reacted. Everything was at once hazy and luminous. By now there were 7 or 8 of us fastening belts and boards onto the 3 tires which would probably never float, 7 or 8 who would probably be killing each other within minutes, for it was clear that the raft would never hold all of us. It was ready. Schlosser and Fahim pushed it toward the water. We followed, like wolves afraid of missing part of the feast. "Wait a minute, I'll give it a try," said Fahim. We all took a step forward. Fahim looked at us. He knew that if he went too far we would kill him. Our silhouettes wavered against the lights which were consuming Memel, and our eyes followed the movement of the raft as it pitched, half submerged on the dark water which melted into the night and fog. As Fahim tried to maintain a balance which every physical law made impossible, he must have prayed to the sadistic god who watched him sink. He didn't jump until the water had risen over his belt, as our safety foundered before our eyes. The night passed slowly, lit by the huge fires. The beach, from which we stared with enormous eyes, shifted from pink to orange. A very young boy from one of the Volksschirm groups had succumbed to despair. His body remained wedged upright in the midst of our group, most of whom didn't even notice that he had died. Another suddenly stood up and walked off, as if hypnotized by the flames in the south, moving toward Memel in a state which was certainly not conscious. We watched him disappear into the brilliant, unreal half-darkness. The Russians could have taken us by surprise now, without any attempt on our part to intercept them. The horrified faces of the last soldiers in the armies of the East were fixed with fascination on the apocalypse of Memel. At daybreak, the fire over the ruins of the town had turned pale yellow, almost white. We were given no orders or coordinates, and remained where we were, motionless and almost senseless, lost in the hideous solitude. Toward the middle of the day, Wallace, our leader, said that he was leaving for Memel. He didn't order us to follow him, but we did. Halfway there, we collapsed on the road. Our strength was gone, and the half mile we had been able to stumble was all we could manage. Somewhere, a short distance to the east, there was still fighting. How was it possible that any of our men still survived? A heavy black cloud with a red base lay motionless across the whole horizon, and to the south, at the docks, there were other fires. Could anyone still be alive in that place? We lay where we were, prostrate and silent, with our eyes fixed on the enormity of the catastrophe. Hours passed. Our lives were running out, and our eyes had a strange fixity. No one thought of opening the few cans we had left. We knew that any food would taste too bitter, with the taste of Memel. Once again, darkness covered us, and our motionless group melted into the fog which lay like a winding sheet over Memel, and stagnated on the sea. Another group of bent men walked slowly by some 10 yards from us. They seemed somehow unreal. Were they German survivors still wandering through this little piece of the void which fate still allowed us? Were they Russians? Or were they, perhaps, a dream? I don't know how long we stayed there. Perhaps for another day and night. No one can be exact about a nightmare. Also, it is a question of no great importance. Some things like Memel cannot be measured by any ordinary scale. I still need corroboration to believe that Memel really happened and is not the fantasy of a spell of madness. Describing it as I have done still makes me tremble with horror and suffer again, for even the memory is painful. The tomb of Memel, where no one has ever gone to meditate, will receive my recollections as a humble and discreet offering. I make no appeals to humanity, and cry for no vengeance. Except for these lines I remain silent, because I have lost my power of discretion. I have also learned, in my solitude, that there is no power more unalterable than the power of forgiveness. At some point, we became aware of sounds from the sea. Every sound from the sea could still mean life. We stood up and listened. The noise, which was scarcely audible, was muffled and heavy, like an idling engine. And then there was the sound of voices at first, blurred and incomprehensible. We walked out into the water, scarcely aware of its touch. Through 2 bursts of thunder, we caught some words. "Here window. Here window." They were asking about window, a city farther to the north. A boat with all its lights out was lost in the fog. The voice kept on calling. It was probably coming through a megaphone. We trembled, and shouted as loud as we could, with what was left of our strength, "Window!" We had all run into the water, like madmen. The first shock revived us for a moment. We went on shouting, as the water reached our chests. Some men stumbled and fell, and then staggered to their feet again, still shouting. Soon the water was up to our chins. We thought we would pull off our clothes and swim. Then the vague outline of the boat emerged from the fog, and we shouted again. The boat scraped against the sand and stopped. Half drowned, we went out to meet our salvation. Swimming, floating, sinking, and surfacing again, we reached the sides of the boat. We could just make out the men leaning over the side, sailors, who were throwing us lines and nets. They were asking us questions, but no one answered. We were all hanging on to anything that was thrown out to us, gasping and imploring. I thrust my fingers into a hole whose edge was encrusted with rivets. My fingers, half dead with cold, gripped like claws. Everyone was shoving and pushing for a rope or net. The icy cold of the water began to break my will. Stiff with suffering, I kept my hold and fought against losing consciousness. An empty cigarette package floated from my pocket and lay on the water some inches from me. I stared at it to fix my wandering attention, and as I stared, my vision grew hazy. Everything had become painless, and I scarcely felt the arms which were pulling me on board. They put me down on the deck, beside my exhausted companions. We were nothing but a shapeless, soaking mass, like a huge mound of wet sacking. Through my semi-consciousness, I realized they were passing around cups of boiling hot tea, which I swallowed down to the peril of my inner organs. My motionless gaze remained fixed on the flaming Prussian coast. I no longer have any clear memory of what happened next. I don't really understand why we didn't die of exposure on the deck. Perhaps the sailors rubbed us to keep us warm. I can only remember one thing clearly: the roar of the war coming from the land dominated all the sounds of the boat and of the sea. Later, the boat arrived at Pillau, where we got off. On trembling legs, surrounded by a flood of refugees, we reached a first aid station, where our physical condition was checked. A multitude of wounded men were sitting or lying all around us in huge open sheds. The little port seemed filled with a sense of feverish agitation and urgency. If the war had not yet arrived, it was nonetheless very close. We sensed its imminence, and could hear its thunder to the northeast. Calvary, Pillau, Kahlberg, Danzig, Goethe and Haifa. In our last battle, we stayed at Pillau for about 3 weeks. We had been declared unfit for service at the front, as we were all more or less wounded, and otherwise in a state which deserved treatment in a sanitarium. Our liquefied brains were no longer able to grasp what was happening to us, or what was asked of us. However, although we were not in a condition to function under fire, this did not mean that we were exempted from service. The staggering flood of refugees which had poured into Pillau did not allow anyone who still had two arms and two legs to remain idle. Along with others whose wounds were more serious than ours, we were absorbed by the first aid organization which was trying to help the civilians waiting to leave, in the face of almost insuperable difficulties. All of these people had lived through a hideous exodus, and the horror of what they had seen was still impressed on their emaciated faces. There was also a swarm of wounded men, soldiers from Königsberg and Kranz, lying about wherever they could. This was often outdoors, in the intense January cold, which sometimes cut short their sufferings. Boats were still putting into Pillau, and leaving filled with people. Three quarters of each load was civilian, the rest, wounded soldiers. This groaning crowd of men, clinging to a last hope of evacuation, was divided into two categories. The most severely wounded, those whose chances of survival were doubtful, who would at best be hideously mutilated, were not embarked. For them, everything was over. The rest, who might still have some hope of a decent life, were eligible for the boats, which, with any luck, would carry them to the west, to that region we still imagined as a zone of relative quiet. For every 1,000 persons embarked, some 3,000 more arrived from the east, swelling the ranks of the mob which had turned to us for help. If the fighting should reach us here, it would be the hell of Memel all over again, only worse. There were many more people here, and the numbers were continuously growing. People were coming in from the south, having crossed the Frisis Haff on anything that would float. They came from Heiligenspiel, Pomerendorf, Elbing, and even from Reusses Holland. They had been told that at Pillau they might be able to get on a boat. We spoke to several of these wretched people. Almost everyone had lost one or two relatives on the way, and described in trembling voices scenes like the ones we had witnessed at Memel. We learned from them that the flight toward Danzig had been cut in two, and that the Russians had reached the Haff at several points. It sounded as if the horror of Memel was duplicated in almost every Prussian coastal town. Swaying on our unsteady legs, we stared at the vast flood of human misery slowly washing toward the safety which had been promised. In spite of the most prodigious efforts, it was clear that these people could not receive even a tenth of what they were expecting. If their prayers had been heard, heaven would have opened to succor their misery. But nothing happened, and misery subsided only for moments at a time, as on the tear-streaked face of a child who has collapsed into a passing sleep. As winter closed in, the thermometer sank toward 5 degrees below zero, only aggravating the plight of the refugees and accelerating the death rate. A crowd stretched as far as the eye could see, in front of a large building crammed with people. From the building a faint smell of the gruel cooking in large cauldrons washed over the tightly compressed mass of people, who stood stamping their feet to keep from freezing. The thudding of their feet against the pavement sounded like a dull roll of muffled drums. The children were the most heart-wringing. Many were lost. When they tired of calling for their mothers, they collapsed into floods of tears which nothing and no one could console. These were the smallest ones, too young to grasp any explanations. Their faces, dabbed with tears which instantly froze, remain one of the most pathetic images of that time. We tried to gather them inside, near the cauldrons, where they might feel some of the heat. We questioned them, hoping for some identifying information we could broadcast over loudspeakers, but they could only reply with tears and sobs. Further on, a large metal cross, which stood on a slight elevation, glittered with frost. It looked like a huge sword, thrust into the breast of catastrophe. Another part of the crowd had collected here to listen to the prayers and encouragement of a priest. The cold grew so intense that the Frisis Haff froze, creating new difficulties for the boats still coming into Pillau. The Frisis Haff froze, and despite the desperate consequences of such cold, the fact was put to use. Hundreds of thousands, on forced marches across the ice, were able to reach the narrow strip of land at Nehrung, and Kalberg, and finally, Danzig. People also left from the pocket at Heiligenspiel. They experienced every sort of hardship, including attacks from Soviet fighter bombers, which tried to break the ice with strings of bombs, and often succeeded. Private cars and other vehicles of every kind frequently disappeared into crevasses covered over by thin films of ice. However, nothing could hold back the flood of refugees, who were prepared to endure most severe hardships. As the Russians grew increasingly active throughout the sector, large numbers of people left Pillau by this providential route. Russian planes were flying over Pillau every day, and it appeared that the defense of Königsberg had given way. As the work at Pillau had become less intense, we planned to evacuate everyone who wasn't strictly essential. It was barely 12 miles from Königsberg to Pillau. The front at Kranz had also been shortened, and before long we too would probably be directly involved in the fighting. We were part of an inadequate reserve composed principally of fragments of broken or annihilated units, from which a certain standard of performance was still expected. No one knew any longer where the rest of the Gross Deutschland might be, but we still wore our divisional flashes on our worn and discolored tunics, and there were still a few familiar names near me, principally Lieutenant Wallers, with a dirty dressing on his right hand, which had lost two fingers, for whom, our disillusioned pastor, Schlosser, Lindburg, who had survived his fear, and our cook, Gransk, who had long ago exchanged his cauldrons for an FM. There were also my friend Hals, whom I will never be able to forget, and I, who have consecrated the rest of my life to bearing witness. Then there were seven or eight others, whose names I never knew, who, with us, made up what was left of the Gross Deutschland division in that area. Had our division been scratched off the list? Not yet, it seemed. An officer hailed us and ordered us to attention. Our eyes, which had already seen so much, studied this grey-faced Hauptmann, who still clung to his sense of disciplinary strength. This discipline, which had so often annoyed us in the past, touched us now like a soothing balm. Its demands were those made of living beings, of creatures still worthy of life. We analyzed no further than that, for us, accustomed as we were to thinking only of the moment, this realization was a kind of dividend. The captain spoke to us, and through his firm, official voice we caught the intense emotion of the crushing load which weighed on all of us, officers and troops, men, women, and children. The time of boasting and gratuitous bullying was so far behind us that no attitude incompatible with the gravity of the circumstances was possible. A man was speaking to us as men. No one could evade the situation. However, this man still wore the vestiges of a military uniform, and was still trying to impose some semblance of order in a situation of cataclysm which had swept an entire nation into a devastating retreat. This man, who knew that everything was lost, was still trying to save the moment. He told us that we would have to withdraw, that we too would have to cross the ice of the Frisishaf, and get to Danzig, where several sizable fragments of our division still remained. He tried to tell us, in a tone which was not peremptory, that there was still work for us to do as part of a particular organization which could be found where he had indicated. He was not trying to spare us a worse disaster when he gave us those orders. The worst was everywhere, and there was no escape. The Hauptmann was already walking toward another group of men, saluting as he withdrew. So we started to walk. A violent wind swept the snow from the mirror-like expanse of ice. In the distance we could hear the gentle purr of the sea, behind us, the steady roar of war. In the evening, we reached the Frisnehung, and the first anti-aircraft bunkers, which barely rose above the long grasses, bent over beneath their burden of snow. To crown my personal difficulties, I fell and injured my foot. It was 40 miles across the Nehrung. I would have to make it anyway. For a long time now, I had known that fate was against me. I found a broken broomstick to use as a crutch. So many people had suffered and died in this place, that my minor discomfort seemed almost indecently trivial. We progressed very slowly. The hollow of a battered, overturned boat sheltered us for a few hours. We were not the only ones to use it. A group of shivering civilians were already inside, groaning as they tried to sleep. I buried my head against Hals's shoulder, hoping to pass out, despite our wretchedness. We reached Kalberg toward the middle of the next day. The small town was overflowing with starving refugees. People with the faces of madmen were wolfing down the flour which was the only food distributed to them. Cans of condensed milk were reserved for the children. Soldiers also had to stand in interminable lines, to receive, finally, two handfuls of flour apiece, and a cup of hot water infused with a minute portion of tea. Our exhausting march resumed amid the pitiable swarms of faltering refugees. Twice we were attacked by Soviet planes, swooping low and scattering missiles which had been designed to destroy tanks. Each impact tore long, bloody furrows in the dense mass, and for a moment the wind was tinged with the warm smell of disemboweled bodies. Above all, I feared for the children, who could no longer understand anything about their situation. They didn't know that the planes were enemy aircraft, or how urgently they were faced with cold and hunger. Everything was a misery for them, and each step a trap. The sky could make them suffer, and the earth hurt them. Their hands and feet made them bite their lips with pain. They were lost in a state of constant fear, which was justified by a world of horror which never lets them forget their pitiable weakness. They stared about them with unseeing eyes at their swollen hands, which they wished were no longer attached to their bodies, at the people around them, who should no longer exist, and at the frozen grasses trembling in the wind, which they would never again enjoy as part of an innocent game.